Today on Vox Talks Economics, the economic burden of burnout. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. Remember, subscribe. Follow us on Instagram as well. This episode is personal for me because I remember when I was a kid suddenly realizing that my dad was home from work all the time. He sat in a chair all day. He was permanently exhausted. He rarely spoke to us at that time. A few months later, he was back at work, but he was never like before. He just didn't seem interested, and emotionally and physically, he struggled to cope with the stress of his job. And later, he took early retirement. Today, we would recognise this as the symptoms of burnout. It's now recognised as a consequence of work-related stress. Which people are more likely to burn out? And what are the long-term effects for people like my dad, for their families, and for the economy as well? Arash Nokoi and Josef Sigurdsson of Stockholm University are two of the authors of a very timely paper that uses Swedish health and employment data to answer these questions. So, welcome to Vox Talks, Josef.
Hey, Tim. Thanks.
Arash, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Josef, we use this term burnout loosely in conversation, well, all the time at the moment. But is there a medical definition for it?
Yeah, that's true. So if you look at the research on burnout, it stretches back to the 1970s, where psychologists, primarily and starting in the US, began noticing high rates of mental exhaustion among workers in stressful occupations. And from this research, we have definitions and classifications of burnout. But more recently, medical boards in different countries, including Sweden and the Netherlands, have set out or classified the symptoms of burnout and set in place diagnosis criteria for diagnosing what we call clinical burnout. So people that are clinically diagnosed and go on sick leave from work.
And we tend to relate this to particular cultures where people have a reputation for working extremely hard. But is it the case that people can burn out anywhere?
It's hard to have a consistent measure of this over time, but we have different measure of both people's own perceived stress at work and burnout. And wherever we look, we see a rising trend, both in people's own perception and also in rates of burnout, both clinical burnout, but also people's own perception of being burned out. And this is true wherever we have the data. We can look to the US and also to Europe.
We care about this much more than we used to, as we should. Mental health is becoming much more recognized, more important. But is it important for policymakers as well?
It's very important for our society, policymakers, our political debate, for two main reasons. One is the rising numbers of, as Josef mentioned, self-reported stress or the amount of people who go on disability or sick leave due to a burnout. But the second dimension that's very important also is the gender imbalance in burnout. Burnout, it's a phenomenon that happens much more among women than men. Mm-hmm. And from a gender equity perspective, that's an issue that we should also take very seriously.
I speak to a lot of academic economists. I'm always struck by how hard you work and how unforgiving the working environment can be sometimes. Is burnout a problem for economists, for academics?
From personal perspective, yes, we know people who are our colleagues who had experience of burnout. But from the data perspective, what we show in our work is that the nature of jobs are different and the amount of stress in the jobs differ. The stress measured in jobs by experts is correlated with the amount of burnout we see among the workers in those jobs. So jobs matters, jobs are different, and our jobs, maybe not the most stressful jobs among all occupations, but is one of them.
Recently, we covered another aspect of mental illness that has unrecognized but devastating consequences. In May, we spoke to Egon Tripodi about how sufferers from depression are often reluctant to seek help because they fear that others will assume they are weak, and what we can do to help them to seek help. Listen to our episode, The Stigma of Depression.
Okay, so let's have a look what your research tells us about who it is that suffers from burnout. So you've used Swedish data for this. Why is Swedish data useful? How much data do you have on this?
So Swedish data is useful for two main reasons. So one key reason is that we need a definition of burnout that is not only consistent over time, but it's not only subjective to individuals' own feelings or interpretation of their experiences at work or outside of work. So what we use is a measure of clinical burnout, people that go on sick leave from work due to burnout, having been diagnosed by a physician. That's one aspect of the data that we have. So we have diagnosis for all of the Swedish workforce dating back to 2006. Mm-hmm. And then we can link this data to various other data sources, including labor market histories, their spouses, children, their outcomes, and what are the jobs that individuals work, what are the types of occupations they hold, and what are the outcomes in the short and the long run. So this gives us a setting where we can explore this phenomena in a very comprehensive way.
And I would imagine that some people would be more susceptible to burnout than others. So what can you know about the tolerance for stress of the people in your sample before they suffer from any symptoms?
That's one of the interesting aspects of the data that we have. So one data source that we draw on is a measure of stress tolerance that comes from the Swedish military. Every man in Sweden goes through a draft procedure at the age of 18. And one of the things that the Swedish military obviously cares about is tolerance to stress. Mm-hmm. So this is measured at the age of 18, as I said, and that's before any labor market experience. So it's not tested in the context of work. It's more general measure of stress tolerance. This is, of course, a proxy measure, but as we show in our work, it seems to correlate very well with likelihood of going on burnout.
With one big inconvenience, which is that the measure we have is only for male workers.
Does that mean there's no equivalent information, there's no equivalent data for female workers?
For much smaller sample, not for the population, because the advantage of this data, the data from the draft, is that it's for population of Sweden, mm-hmm. or almost population, whereas the data for female workers is in a very small samples.
Also, you need to know about the impact of high-stress jobs that you mentioned before, Arash. Some jobs are higher stress than others. But when you're looking at the impact of those jobs on burnout, people don't randomly assign into different jobs. So how can you discover the causal impact of working in high-stress jobs?
It could have been the world where the job's different in the amount of stress they have. People are different, have a different degree of their risk tolerance, but people select themselves into the jobs that are good for them. So stress-tolerant people go to stressful jobs, stress-non-tolerant people go to less stressful jobs, and at the end, mm-hmm. the burnout rate for all of them are the same. So what we show in our work is that there is selection. There is some assortative selection, if you want, assortative mating between jobs and workers. So less stress-tolerant people go to less stressful jobs. But when we look at the jobs that they are least stressful, the amount of burnout is not correlated with the stress tolerance of individuals. There is a low level of burnout, but it's the same for everyone. But when we look at the stressful jobs, mm-hmm. the stressful jobs are very harmful specifically for people with a low stress tolerance. And one step beyond that, this kind of patterns in the data, is that we look at people when they change jobs. We see people when they change jobs. For example, when they go from the very unstressful job to a very stressful job, their burnout rates increases. In the same way, when they go from a very stressful job to an under-stressful job, their burnout rate decreases. And what is very surprising is that this adjustment in the burnout rates, it doesn't need too much time. In almost a year, the burnout rate of individuals adjusts to their new occupation, to their new jobs. We should be careful about the term also, because we can think about individuals changing firms or changing occupation.
Yes.
And both jobs, firms and occupations can be stressful, and they matter when we look at, we follow the individuals. But what's important is that even within the firms, going from unstressful jobs to stressful jobs increase the burnout rates. So to us, it seems to suggest that what matters is really the nature of the job beyond the culture that is common within the firm across occupations.
And is your definition of a high-stress firm, is that based on how likely people are to burn out when they do those jobs?
Thanks for asking that question, because what's very important is that we are measuring the stressfulness of the occupation
yeah.
Using the experts in the US that they just look at the nature of a job and measured how stressful the job is. So it's really not about the workers in that job. The pilot is a very stressful job, or nurse is a very stressful job, because it's just nature of those jobs are different than a librarian, let's say. But for firms, it's different, because for firms, we don't have such a measure. For firms, what you're using, exactly what you said, which is the amount of burnout among the colleagues or among the generations before who were in that firm.
So can we quantify how much more likely it is that someone's going to burn out in a high-stress job than a low-stress job?
If you look at the extreme situation where individual is moving from a job that we classify in the bottom among stressful jobs to the most stressful jobs, it almost quadruples the likelihood of burnout in the year subsequent to moving.
Wow.
So if that individual had moved to a similarly low stressful job, his likelihood of burnout wouldn't have changed at all.
Wow. Quadrupling within a year is a huge difference. So how are you identifying that it's specifically burnout causing any consequences for individuals here, rather than something else in their personality or their environment that could be related to burnout?
It's a hard task. We compare individuals that burn out at a specific point in time, and we match them to similar individuals in terms of the labor market histories leading up to the burnout event, but who either don't burn out or burn out later in their life. So essentially, in the first type of research design, we are just using the comparison between those that do burn out and those that don't burn out. And in the latter, we're using the timing of the burnout event. Now, of course, there could be many things that influence people going into burnout, and we could be picking up those consequences as well. And we look at that in the paper. But one thing that we can do is that we can look at individuals working in different stressful environments and using that as the kind of the trigger for people going into burnout. And that's also what we leverage in this design.
So looking at the trajectory of earnings for people who burn out, what is that pattern?
So the pattern we find is very surprising. What we expected initially was a drop in earnings. What we found out is very similar to what economists are very familiar with, which is the displacement effect. What we see is a drop of earning, it seems to be permanent. So the drop is around 13% for men, 11% for women, and it's permanent. At least within 7 years, we don't see any sign of convergence.
That's an enormous drop. What's causing it? Are they working in different jobs? Are they working less? Are people out of the labor force?
So when we decompose this effect, we look at both the extensive margin, meaning people are either partially employed or out of the labor force entirely, or earnings within the same job or across jobs. All of the earnings effect is driven by an extensive margin. Half of that is people that are working now part-time, they used to work full-time, or individuals that are out of the labor force entirely. We don't see any effect on earnings in their current jobs or people moving jobs and earning less. If anything, people move to different jobs, they seem to earn slightly more.
Now, you mentioned that women were more likely to burn out, and the impact of burnout is roughly equivalent.
That's right. But what's important we should mention is that when we look at the spouses of people, again, there is a gender inequality.
Ah.
If a man getting burnout, not only he suffers for a permanent earning loss, but also his wife is suffering a considerable income loss. It's the same thing is not true all the way around. When a woman getting a burnout, their spouses don't get necessarily considerable earning loss. A small earning loss is much smaller in magnitude.
That's fascinating. What about the kids?
This even goes beyond spouses. And if you look at children, we look at both their performance in school and their likelihood of going into post-compulsory education. And we see that children who have a parent that experiences burnout in the lead up to high-stakes exam or in the years when they are in compulsory school, they are both less likely to go into college and they perform substantially worse on high-stakes exams. So this would translate into potentially lower earnings in the future, assuming that there is some return to education for the children, as we normally measure in the economics literature. So this is actually what we use when we go to quantify the aggregate impact of burnout.
One thing that's very surprising, maybe the most surprising result that we found, is the effect of burnout on fertility. Because the effect that Joseph mentioned is the effect of burnout on kids who are, you know, 10 years old and their parents getting burnout and what happens to their educational outcomes. But what happened to the fertility of the individuals? For women, the fertility goes down after a burnout. For men, The fertility goes down for the first 2 years after the burnout, but then there's a recovery, initial recovery, in the sense that there is overshooting. The fertility goes up for men in the long run after a burnout. It seems to be difficult to interpret, but one way of looking at it is that for women, career and family seems to be complements to each other. So once that the career is affected, the family is affected in the same way. But for men, these two things are substitute in a way that, you know, if I lose my career, maybe I focus more on my family because I think I need success somewhere in my life. I think of them as a substitute to each other. That's one way of interpreting it, but it's open to interpretation. That just the result is striking that this fertility drops for women and increases for men in the long run as a result of burnouts.
As you're describing all these effects, it makes me remember just how terrible burnout is and the effects of it are, but it's also in some ways very normal. We almost accept it. If we add all this together, is there an aggregate economic impact that we can come up with of burnout?
So we have described many type of effects that we see. The first is the direct effect of individuals going into burnout. They go on sick leave. They are not at work. Mm-hmm. And then there are these effects on individual careers and also the spillover effects. When we aggregate this all up and we measure the aggregate loss in labor due to burnout measured by lost labor income, we find that in 2019, it amounted to 2.3%. This consists of this direct effect. Large part of it is individuals' own permanent income loss. And then there are these spillover effects, both lower earnings for spouses and also lower income for children due to less schooling and earnings in the future.
And we knew that this 2.3% does not do the justice to show the aggregate impact of burnout because of two reasons. One is that burnout rate is increasing over time. Second is that the data starts only in 2006. So the kids that are affected today or that were affected in 2015, they're not yet in the labor market to measure their impact of the burnout on their income in the future. So what we did is that we added to this study by thought experiments of let's assume that the world stays as of 2019. Mm-hmm. So burnout rate doesn't increase, but stays as of today. How much would be this aggregate impact be in that world, in the steady state world, as in the language of economists? So the number goes up from 2.3% to 3.5%.
Wow. These are huge numbers for something that you would think could mostly be avoided. So could we be doing a better job of identifying the symptoms of burnout before it happens? Because then we could do a better job of treating it.
This is a very important question. So Dominic, Joseph and I, when we started work on this project, one of our motivations was the number of people in our surroundings who experienced burnout. But what's important is that all of them did not burnout, in the sense that many of them managed to avoid burnout by taking serious the light symptoms of a burnout early on.
Right.
When they realize that they're losing their short-run memory, they slow down their work, they reach out for help, and they try to avoid the complete burnout. And that brings us to a part of our work where we use a survey in Sweden, which is independently done, so does not have administrative consequences. In that survey, they ask people about their stress. They ask whether you know, their sleep is affected by the stress from work. They ask them whether they can disconnect from work when they come home, but they also ask them about other features of their jobs. It seems that lack of sleep or mental stress or, for example, sexual harassment at work, these are positively correlated with a likelihood of burnout in the next calendar year. This suggests to us that one could ask workers about their mental conditions and try to use that to prevent or to assess the likelihood of burnout in the future. We talked to some Swedish firms. It turns out that many of them have such a surveys. They are performing such a surveys within their firms. However, these surveys are done at the individual level anonymously. So what they know is their, you know, the amount of stress in different parts of their firms. But they're not using the surveys at the individual level to prevent burnout. But what we show in the paper is that actually it can be quite an important tool to flag individuals who are in the risk of burnout. And we did the welfare calculation, or the, if you want, cost-benefit calculation of how we could use such a surveys and other administrative data to find workers they need help and provide them with preventive programs.
As you say, that information is out there or it could be obtained. But if we identify more people at risk of burnout, then obviously there is a cost to addressing that, to dealing with that. At the crudest level, the cost benefit, is it worth it?
Yeah, it seems, according to our calculation, that it is. So if we compare the net benefit of carrying out such a program with using just basic information about individuals compared to adding the survey, the gain from adding the survey increases by 2.5 times compared to using only basic characteristics.
Now, you've identified something here that everyone will be able to relate to. If we do not take burnout seriously and continue to tolerate it, as we're doing now, what is the cost to the economy, to individual and families? How would you describe that?
I think our aggregate calculation put this in perspective, showing that the aggregate loss in labor is substantial. As we said, 2.3% of total labor income being lost in a year. But there are a lot of other channels that we highlight that we are not incorporating into that. One aspect we mentioned before is this stark gender difference. If women are much more likely to burn out because they work in potentially more stressful jobs, then that this might negatively impact their labor market participation or their careers, and therefore influence gender equality in the labor market, which is something that we all care about. This is something that is hard to quantify, but it's definitely a negative side effect of the burnout patterns that we document in the paper.
Thank you for talking about this research. Thank you for doing it as well. Josef?
Thank you very much, Tim, for having us.
And Arash?
Thanks, Tim.
The paper is discussion paper 19091 at CPR. It's called The Economic Burden of Burnout, and what an economic burden that turns out to be. The authors, Arash Nakoi, Josef Sigurdsson, and Dominic Fair.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Thank you for listening. If you don't want to miss an episode in future, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, has the EU been an economic miracle?